This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
My name is Joanna Harris, and I will be reading Babushka by Carolyn Sherwin Bailey. It was the night the dear Christ child came to Bethlehem. In a country far away from him, an old woman named Babushka sat in her snug little house by her warm fire. The wind was drifting the snow outside and howling down the chimney, but it only made Babushka's fire burn more brightly. "How glad I am that I may stay indoors," said Babushka, holding her hands out to the bright blaze. But suddenly she heard a loud rap at her door. She opened it, and her candle shone on three old men standing outside in the snow. Their beards were as white as the snow, so long that they reached the ground. Their eyes shone kindly in the light of Babushka's candle, and their arms were full of precious things, boxes of jewels and sweet-smelling oils and ointments. "We have traveled far, Babushka," they said, "and we stopped to tell you of the baby prince born this night in Bethlehem. He comes to rule the world and teach all men to be loving and true. We carry him gifts. Come with us, Babushka." But Babushka looked at the driving snow and inside her cozy room at the crackling fire. "It is too late to go with you, good sirs," she said. "The weather is too cold." She went inside again and shut the door, and the old men journeyed on to Bethlehem without her. But as Babushka sat by her fire, rocking, she began to think about the little Christ child, for she loved all babies. "Tomorrow I will go find him," she said. "Tomorrow, when it is light, and I will carry him some toys." So when it was morning, Babushka put on her long cloak and took her staff and filled her basket with the pretty things a baby would like, gold balls and wooden toys and strings of silver cobwebs, and she set out to find the Christ child. But, oh, Babushka had forgotten to ask the three old men the road to Bethlehem, and they had traveled so far through the night that she could not overtake them. Up and down the road she hurried, through woods and fields and towns, saying to whomever she met, "I go to find the Christ child. Where does he lie? I bring him some pretty toys for his sake." But no one could tell her the way to go, and they all said, "Farther on, Babushka, farther on." So she traveled on and on and on for years and years, but she never found the little Christ child. They say that old Babushka is traveling still, looking for him. When it comes Christmas Eve and the children are lying fast asleep, Babushka comes softly through the snowy fields and towns, wrapped in her long cloak and carrying her basket on her arm. With her staff, she raps gently at the doors and goes inside and holds her candle close to the children's faces. "Is he here?" she asks. "Is the little Christ child here?" And then she turns sorrowfully away again, crying, "Farther on, farther on." But before she leaves, she takes a toy from her basket and lays it beside the pillow for a Christmas gift. "For his sake," she says softly, and then hurries on through the years and forever in search of the little Christ child.
This is Katie Anderson reading 6 to 8 Black Men by David Sedaris. I've never been much for guidebooks, so when trying to get my bearings in a strange American city, I normally start by asking the cab driver or hotel clerk some silly question regarding the latest census figures. I say silly because I don't really care how many people live in Olympia, Washington, or Columbus, Ohio. They're nice enough places, but the numbers mean nothing to me. My second question might have to do with the average annual rainfall, which, again, doesn't tell me anything about the people who have chosen to call this place home. What really interests me are the local gun laws. Can I carry a concealed weapon? And if so, under what circumstances? What's the waiting period for a Tommy gun? Could I buy a Glock 17 if I were recently divorced or fired from my job? I've learned from experience that it's best to lead into this subject as delicately as possible, especially if you and the local citizen are alone and enclosed in a relatively small space. Bide your time, though, and you can walk away with some excellent stories. I've heard, for example, that the blind can legally hunt in both Texas and Michigan. They must be accompanied by a sighted companion, but still, it seems a bit risky. You wouldn't want a blind person driving a car or piloting a plane, so why hand him a rifle? What sense does that make? I ask about guns not because I want one of my own, but because the answers vary so widely from state to state. In a country that's become so homogenous, I'm reassured by these last touches of regionalism. Guns aren't really an issue in Europe, so when I'm traveling abroad, my first question usually relates to barnyard animals. What do your roosters say is a good icebreaker, as every country has its own unique interpretation. In Germany, where dogs bark "vow vow," and both the frog and the duck say "quack," the rooster greets the dawn with a hearty "kikariki." Greek roosters crow "kiriaki," and in France they scream "cocorico," which sounds like one of those horrible premixed cocktails with a pirate on the label. When told that an American rooster says cock-a-doodle-doo, my hosts look at me with disbelief and pity. When do you open your Christmas presents is another good conversation starter, as it explains a lot about national character. People who traditionally open gifts on Christmas Eve seem a bit more pious and family-oriented than those who wait till Christmas morning. They go to Mass, open presents, eat a late meal, return to church the following morning, and devote the rest of the day to eating another big meal. Gifts are generally reserved for children, and the parents tend not to go overboard. It's nothing I'd want for myself, but I suppose it's fine for those who prefer food and family to things of real value. In France and Germany, gifts are exchanged on Christmas Eve, while in Holland, the children receive presents on December 5th, in celebration of St. Nicholas Day. It sounded sort of quaint until I spoke to a man named Oscar, who filled me in on a few of the details as we walked from my hotel to the Amsterdam train station. Unlike the jolly, obese American Santa, St. Nicholas is painfully thin and dresses not unlike the Pope, topping his robes with a tall hat resembling an embroidered tea cozy. The outfit, I was told, is a carryover from his former career, when he served as a bishop in Turkey. One doesn't want to be too much of a cultural chauvinist, but this seemed completely wrong to me. For starters, Santa didn't used to do anything. He's not retired, and more important, he has nothing to do with Turkey. The climate's all wrong, and people wouldn't appreciate him. When asked how he got from Turkey to the North Pole, Oscar told me with complete conviction that St. Nicholas currently resides in Spain, which, again, is simply not true. While he could probably live wherever he wanted, Santa chose the North Pole specifically because it is harsh and isolated. No one can spy on him, and he doesn't have to worry about people coming to the door. Anyone can come to the door in Spain, and in that outfit, he'd most certainly be recognized. On top of that, aside from a few pleasantries, Santa doesn't speak Spanish. He knows enough to get by, but he's not fluent, and he certainly doesn't eat tapas. While our Santa flies on a sled, St. Nicholas arrives by boat and then transfers to a white horse. The event is televised, and great crowds gather at the waterfront to greet him. I'm not sure if there's a set date, but he generally docks in late November and spends a few weeks hanging out and asking people what they want. "Is it just him alone?" I asked. "Or does he come with some backup?" Oscar's English was close to perfect, but he seemed thrown by a term normally reserved for police reinforcement. "Helpers," I said. "Does he have any elves?" Maybe I'm just overly sensitive, but I couldn't help but feel personally insulted when Oscar denounced the very idea as grotesque and unrealistic. "Elves?" he said. "They're just so silly." The words silly and unrealistic were redefined when I learned that St. Nicholas travels with what was consistently described as 6 to 8 black men. I asked several Dutch people to narrow it down, but none of them could give me an exact number. It was always 6 to 8, which seems strange, seeing as they've had hundreds of years to get a decent count. The 6 to 8 black men were characterized as personal slaves until the mid-50s, when the political climate changed and it was decided that instead of being slaves, they were just good friends. I think history has proven that something usually comes between slavery and friendship, a period of time marked not by cookies and quiet times beside the fire, but by bloodshed and mutual hostility. They have such violence in Holland, but rather than duking it out amongst themselves, Santa and his former slaves decided to take it out on the public. In the early years, if a child was naughty, St. Nicholas and the 6 to 8 black men would beat him with what Oscar described as the small branch of a tree. A switch? Yes, he said, that's it. They'd kick him and beat him with a switch. Then, if the youngster was really bad, they'd put him in a sack and take him back to Spain. St. Nicholas would kick you? Well, not anymore, Oscar said. Now he just pretends to kick you. And the 6 to 8 black men? Them too. He considered this to be progressive, but in a way I think it's almost more perverse than the original punishment. I'm going to hurt you, but not really. How many times have we fallen for that line? The fake slap invariably makes contact, adding the elements of shock and betrayal to what had previously been plain old-fashioned fear. What kind of Santa spends his time pretending to kick people before stuffing them into a canvas sack? Then, of course, you've got the 6 to 8 former slaves who could potentially go off at any moment. This, I think, is the greatest difference between us and the Dutch. While a certain segment of our population might be perfectly happy with the arrangement, if you told the average American that 6 to 8 nameless black men would be sneaking into his house in the middle of the night, he would barricade the doors and arm himself with whatever he could get his hands on. 6 to 8, did you say? In the years before central heating, Dutch children would leave their shoes by the fireplace, the promise being that unless they planned to beat you, kick you, or stuff you into a sack, St. Nicholas and the 6 to 8 black men would fill your clogs with presents. Aside from the threats of violence and kidnapping, it's not much different from hanging your stockings from the mantle. Now that so few people have a working fireplace, Dutch children are instructed to leave their shoes beside the radiator, furnace, or space heater. St. Nicholas and the 6 to 8 black men arrive on horses, which jump from the yard onto the roof. At this point, I guess they either jump back down and use the door, or they stay put and vaporize through the pipes and electrical wires. Oscar wasn't too clear about the particulars, but really, who can blame him? We have the same problem with our Santa. He's supposed to use the chimney, but if you don't have one, he still manages to come through. It's best not to think about it too hard. While 8 flying reindeer are a hard pill to swallow, our Christmas story remains relatively simple. Santa lives with his wife in a remote polar village and spends one night a year traveling around the world. If you're bad, he leaves you coal. If you're good and live in America, he'll give you just about anything you want. We tell our children to be good and send them off to bed where they lie awake anticipating their great bounty. A Dutch parent has a decidedly hairier story to relate, telling his children, "Listen, you might want to pack a few of your things together before you go to bed. The former bishop from Turkey will be coming along with 6 to 8 black men. They might put some candy in your shoes, they might stuff you in a sack and take you to Spain, or they might just pretend to kick you. We don't know for sure, but we want you to be prepared." This is the reward for living in Holland. As a child, you get to hear this story, and as an adult, you get to turn around and repeat it. As an added bonus, the government has thrown in legalized drugs and prostitution. So what's not to love about being Dutch? Oscar finished his story just as we arrived at the station. He was a polite and interesting guy, very good company. But when he offered to wait until my train arrived, I begged off, saying I had some calls to make. Sitting alone in the vast terminal, surrounded by other polite, seemingly interesting Dutch people, I couldn't help but feel second rate. Yes, it was a small country, but it had 6 to 8 black men and a really good bedtime story. Being a fairly competitive person, I felt jealous, then bitter, and was edging toward hostile when I remembered the blind hunter tramping off into the Michigan forest. He might bag a deer, or he might happily shoot his sighted companion in the stomach. He may find his way back to the car, or he may wander around for a week or two before stumbling through your front door. We don't know for sure, but in pinning that license to his chest, he inspires the sort of narrative that ultimately makes me proud to be an American.
Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is a series of Hanukkah stories. They are the Chelm stories. Chełm is a town in Poland, but the Chełm of these stories is pretty much universal. I hope you enjoy. This is from the book The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel. The first story is called The Jar of Fools. Everyone knows that Chełm is a town of fools, or so it is said. The question is, if the people of Chełm are truly as foolish as everyone believes they are, how did so many of them come to be gathered in one place? And why is that place Chełm? According to one legend, it happened a long time ago, just after Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden. God looked down from heaven. He saw that the number of human beings in the world was growing. Soon they would spread all over the earth. All the new human beings who were going to be born would need souls. God made a great kettle in the sky. Using the Big Dipper as a spoon and the Little Dipper as a ladle, he mixed up a huge number of souls. Some of the souls liked to quarrel, others were peaceful. God looked at the souls he had made and said, "It is not good for all the quarrelsome souls to be in one place, and all the peaceful souls to be in another. If that were to happen, the quarrelsome nations would have no one to temper their aggression. The peaceful nations would have no one to defend them. It is better for these souls to be distributed evenly. Every country would then have citizens who value peace as well as others capable of waging war." God put the quarrelsome souls in one jar and the peaceful souls in another. He gave each jar to an angel, telling them to spread the souls all over the earth, making sure there were not too many of either kind in one place or too few in another. The angels did as God commanded. God looked down and saw it was good. God took the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper in hand again and mixed up another batch of souls. Some were honest, and some were dishonest. God looked at the souls and said, "It is not good for all these souls to be in one place either. Justice and honor cannot thrive in a nation where everyone is a scoundrel. There must be honest folk to control the dishonest ones. Only then will honor and justice be valued." God put the honest souls into one jar and the dishonest into another. He handed each jar to an angel, telling them to spread the souls throughout the world. The angels did as God commanded. God looked down and saw that it was good. God filled up the kettle for a third time. He made another batch of souls. Some were wise and some were foolish. God looked at the souls he made and said, "It is not good for all the wise people and all the foolish people to be in one place. The wise would become so clever that nobody would be able to understand them. The fools would tumble blindly into folly. Let both kinds of souls be distributed evenly across the earth, as was done with the others." God put the wise souls into one jar and the foolish souls into another. He handed each jar to an angel, saying, "Take these souls and distribute them evenly. Let there not be too many of either kind in one place or too few in another." The first angel took the jar containing the wise souls and spread them over the earth. That is why there are wise people in every family, in every town, in every nation. However, the angel carrying the jar with the foolish souls was a Butterfingers. He was flying along when the jar slipped from his hands. It fell to the ground and shattered. That is how all the truly foolish souls came to be in one place. That place is Chełm. However, there is another version of this story. According to that version, the jar the angel dropped was not the one containing foolish souls at all, but the one filled with wise souls. That is how the people of Chełm came to be so wise that nobody else understands them. Everybody regards them as fools. But are they really? No one can say, for no one knows which version of the story is true. However, that's how they tell it in Chełm. Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is a Hanukkah story from Chełm. The book is called The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel. How they play dreidel in Chełm. Everybody knows about dreidels. A dreidel is a four-sided top with one Hebrew letter on each side. The letters are Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin. They stand for the Hebrew words Nes, Gadol, Chaya, Sham. In English, that means a great miracle happened there. The sages of Chelm were playing dreidel one Chanukah evening when the oldest, Motke Fool, said, "I think this dreidel has too many letters." "How can a dreidel have too many letters?" the others asked. "For thousands of years, dreidels have had the same four letters, Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin. They remind us of the miracle of Chanukah." "I still think four letters are too many. We don't need all of them," said Motke. "Which ones would you like to get rid of?" "I'd get rid of the letter Shin," said Motke. "What does it stand for?" "Sham, which means there." "Why do we need this letter? We know the miracle happened there, in the land of Israel. It didn't happen here in Chelm." "Nothing ever happens in Chelm." "You're right," the sages agreed. They took a bottle of ink and blotted out the letter Shin. "I know another letter we can get rid of," said Simon Goose. "Consider He." "What does it stand for?" "Chaya, which means happened." "Obviously the miracle happened. If it didn't happen, we wouldn't be celebrating Chanukah. Today would be just an ordinary day." "That's true," the sages agreed, as they blotted out the letter He. Then Beryl Dunce piped up, "I know another letter we can do without." "Which one?" "Gimel. It stands for Gadol, meaning great. Why do we need to say a great miracle? Aren't all miracles great? Who ever heard of an ordinary miracle?" "What wisdom!" the sages exclaimed as they blotted out the letter Gimel. "Wait, we're not done," said Fivel Bonehead. "Look at Nun. What does it stand for?" "Nes, which means miracle. I ask you, when a tiny band of Jews, no braver or smarter than we are, defeats a great nation like the mighty Greeks of old, what do you call it?" "A miracle." "Of course, everybody knows that. We don't need some silly letter to remind us." So the sages of Chelm took the bottle of ink and blotted out the remaining letter, Nun. Ever since that time, dreidels in Chelm have been made without letters. The four sides are blank. So how do they play the dreidel game? The same way everyone else plays it, with dreidels, coins, nuts, candies. Except in Chelm, strange to say, whenever they play dreidel, everyone always wins. Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is another Chanukah story from Chelm. The book is called The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel. Sweeter than honey, purer than oil. One afternoon, Esther Goose said to her son, "Belville, tonight our cousins are coming over for Chanukah. I don't have enough chicken fat to cook the latkes. Here's a zloty. Be a good boy. Go to the market and buy a pound of chicken fat for me. Hurry, the market will close soon." Belville took the zloty and started out the door. "Belville, wait!" his mother called after him. "There is chicken fat, and there is chicken fat. Don't let anyone cheat you. Be sure to buy only the best." "Don't worry, Mama," Belville called back. "I'll remember. Only the best." Belville ran to the market. He stopped at the butcher's stall. "Do you have any chicken fat?" he asked. The butcher laughed. "Do I have chicken fat? Of course I have chicken fat. How could I call myself a butcher and not have chicken fat?" "Ah, but what kind of chicken fat is it?" "What kind?" "The best. My chicken fat is as smooth as butter." Belville began to think. If chicken fat is as smooth as butter, then butter must be better than chicken fat. Mama said, buy only the best. I'll buy butter. Never mind, he told the butcher, and ran to the dairyman's stall. Do you have any butter? He asked the dairyman. Do I have butter? Of course I have butter. My butter is as sweet as honey. If butter is as sweet as honey, then honey must be better than butter. I'll buy honey, thought Velvel. Never mind, he told the dairyman. He ran to the honey seller's booth. Do you have any honey? He asked the honey seller. Do I have honey? Of course I have honey. My honey is as clear as oil. Velvel thought, if honey is as clear as oil, then oil must be better than honey. I'll buy oil. Never mind, Velvel said. He ran to the oil seller's shop. Do you have any oil? He asked the oil seller. Of course I have oil, the very best. My oil is as pure as water. Aha, thought Velvel. If oil is as pure as water, then water must be better than oil. Why should I waste Mama's zloty? I can get water for free. Never mind, Velvel said. He ran to the town pump just as the market was closing. He borrowed a jug and filled it with water. He carried the jug home. Mama, I'm back from the market, Velvel called when he arrived. Such a good boy, you're back just in time. Our cousins will be coming soon. Did you bring the chicken fat I asked for? No, Mama, I brought you something better than chicken fat. What could be better than chicken fat for cooking latkes? Think, Mama. Close your eyes and guess. It's as smooth as butter. Butter? Sweet as honey. Honey? Clear as oil. Oil? And pure as... He handed her the jug. Esther Goose opened her eyes wide. Water? Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is one of the Hanukkah stories from The Jar of Fools by Eric Kimmel. It's called The Night of the Golden Slippers. The greatest honor in Chelm is to be named a Knight of the Golden Slippers. This honor is awarded on the first night of Hanukkah to the wisest person in town. That person gets to wear a special pair of golden slippers for an entire year. The first person to win the award was Matke Fool. One Hanukkah Eve, he made the astonishing discovery that matches could be lighted by striking them against the side of the box. Before that, people in Chelm used to light matches by kindling a fire in the stove and holding the match in the flame until it ignited. It was a lot of trouble, and they frequently burned their fingers, especially during Hanukkah season when there are lots of candles to light. The people of Chelm tried to think of a way to honor Matke. I have an idea, said Beryl Dunce. Who was the wisest person who ever lived? King Solomon. That's what the Bible says. And what did Solomon wear on his feet? Golden slippers. Let's make a pair of golden slippers for Matke. Everyone who comes to Chelm will know that our Matke is as wise as King Solomon. The sages of Chelm liked this idea, especially when Beryl, a shoemaker by trade, offered to make the slippers for free. Of course he wasn't going to make them out of real gold. Beryl was a poor man. He couldn't afford to do that. He made the slippers out of leather and painted them gold. But when they were polished, oh, how they shined! King Solomon himself never owned a finer pair. Matke proudly walked up and down the muddy streets of Chelm, showing off his golden slippers. He soon discovered a problem. "These slippers don't work," Matke complained. "What's wrong?" everyone asked. "I hardly take two steps, and my beautiful golden slippers are covered with mud. What good is wearing golden slippers if nobody can see them?" This was a serious problem. The sages of Chelm thought long and hard about what to do. Finally, Simple Kalman had an idea. What do farmers wear in winter? They wear thick felt boots that come all the way to their knees. We'll get Matka a pair of those boots. Then he can walk around as much as he pleases, and not a speck of mud will get on his golden slippers. The sages of Chelm bought a thick pair of boots from the next farmer to come through town. Matka put them on. He was very pleased. Now he could walk around Chelm all day without muddying his golden slippers. However, another problem appeared. The boots keep out the mud, but they also hide the slippers. Matka was right. If nobody could see the slippers, nobody could know how wise he was. If nobody knew how wise he was, what was the point in wearing them? The sages of Chelm had to start thinking again. After a while, Simon Goose spoke up. The boots are made of felt. Felt isn't hard to cut. We'll cut holes in the boots. Then the golden slippers can show through. Simon took the boots back to his tailor shop and cut out pretty patterns of menorahs and dreidels in honor of Chanukah. When Matka put the boots back on, the golden slippers shined through the cutout patterns. Everyone could see the slippers, and the clumsy boots themselves were now beautifully decorated with golden menorahs and dreidels. Matka went for a walk. He soon returned, completely discouraged. These boots don't work. It's the same problem. Mud comes through the holes and covers the slippers. What to do? I know, said Stupid Schmelke, the town beggar. My boots are always full of holes. Do I worry? No, I stuff them with straw. The straw keeps out the mud, and my feet stay dry. Now that was thinking. The sages of Chelm stuffed some straw into Matka's boots. Matka put them on and went for another walk. Again he returned, shaking his head. It still doesn't work. The straw keeps the mud out, but it also fills the holes so nobody can see the slippers. This was becoming a serious problem. Even so, the sages of Chelm never despaired. They had faith that they would find an answer if they thought hard enough. After all, why else had God given them brains? Maybe we should start over, said Fidel Bonehead. Let's forget the slippers. We'll find some other way to honor Matka. What if he wears a special hat? Nobody cared for that idea. Matka liked the slippers, and Beryl had worked hard to make them. I know, said Stupid Schmelke. Matka can keep the slippers, but why must he wear them on his feet? Couldn't he wear them someplace else where they wouldn't get muddy and everyone could see them? Where? He could wear them on his hands. But I need to use my hands, said Matka. How can I pick up anything if my hands are inside a pair of slippers? You could tie them on a string and hang them round your neck, Esther Goose suggested. That's a stupid idea. My beard would cover them. Well, then stick them on your ears, snapped Esther. Ah, now that was a solution. Matka could wear the slippers on his ears. The slippers would keep his ears warm, everyone would be able to see them, and they wouldn't get covered with mud. Ever since that day, people honored as Knights of the Golden Slippers have the privilege of wearing a pair of slippers on their ears for an entire year. That's why it is always easy to identify Chelm's wisest, most honored, and distinguished citizen. He's the one who walks around with a pair of slippers on his ears. Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is one of the Chanukah stories from The Jar of Fools by Eric Kimmel. It's called The Knight of the Golden Slippers. The greatest honor in Chelm is to be named a Knight of the Golden Slippers. This honor is awarded on the first night of Chanukah to the wisest person in town. That person gets to wear a special pair of golden slippers for an entire year. The first person to win the award was Matka Fool. One Hanukkah Eve, he made the astonishing discovery that matches could be lighted by striking them against the side of the box. Before that, people in Chelm used to light matches by kindling a fire in the stove and holding the match in the flame until it ignited. It was a lot of trouble, and they frequently burned their fingers, especially during Hanukkah season when there are lots of candles to light. The people of Chelm tried to think of a way to honor Matke. "I have an idea," said Beryl Dunce. "Who was the wisest person who ever lived?" "King Solomon." "That's what the Bible says. And what did Solomon wear on his feet?" "Golden slippers." "Let's make a pair of golden slippers for Matke. Everyone who comes to Chelm will know that our Matke is as wise as King Solomon." The sages of Chelm liked this idea, especially when Beryl, a shoemaker by trade, offered to make the slippers for free. Of course he wasn't going to make them out of real gold. Beryl was a poor man. He couldn't afford to do that. He made the slippers out of leather and painted them gold. But when they were polished, oh, how they shined! King Solomon himself never owned a finer pair. Matke proudly walked up and down the muddy streets of Chelm, showing off his golden slippers. He soon discovered a problem. "These slippers don't work," Matke complained. "What's wrong?" everyone asked. "I hardly take two steps, and my beautiful golden slippers are covered with mud. What good is wearing golden slippers if nobody can see them?" This was a serious problem. The sages of Chelm thought long and hard about what to do. Finally, Simple Kalman had an idea. "What do farmers wear in winter? They wear thick felt boots that come all the way to their knees. We'll get Matke a pair of those boots. Then he can walk around as much as he pleases, and not a speck of mud will get on his golden slippers." The sages of Chelm bought a thick pair of boots from the next farmer to come through town. Matke put them on. He was very pleased. Now he could walk around Chelm all day without muddying his golden slippers. However, another problem appeared. "The boots keep out the mud, but they also hide the slippers." Matke was right. If nobody could see the slippers, nobody could know how wise he was. If nobody knew how wise he was, what was the point in wearing them? The sages of Chelm had to start thinking again. After a while, Simon Goose spoke up. "The boots are made of felt. Felt isn't hard to cut. We'll cut holes in the boots, then the golden slippers can show through." Simon took the boots back to his tailor shop and cut out pretty patterns of menorahs and dreidels in honor of Chanukah. When Matke put the boots back on, the golden slippers shined through the cutout patterns. Everyone could see the slippers, and the clumsy boots themselves were now beautifully decorated with golden menorahs and dreidels. Matke went for a walk. He soon returned, completely discouraged. "These boots don't work. It's the same problem. Mud comes through the holes and covers the slippers." "What to do?" I know, said Stupid Schmelke, the town beggar. "My boots are always full of holes. Do I worry? No, I stuff them with straw. The straw keeps out the mud, and my feet stay dry." Now that was thinking. The sages of Chelm stuffed some straw into Matke's boots. Matke put them on and went for another walk. Again he returned, shaking his head. "It still doesn't work. The straw keeps the mud out, but it also fills the holes so nobody can see the slippers." This was becoming a serious problem. Even so, the sages of Chelm never despaired. They had faith that they would find an answer if they thought hard enough. After all, why else had God given them brains? "Maybe we should start over," said Fidel Bonehead. "Let's forget the slippers. We'll find some other way to honor Matke." "What if he wears a special hat?" Nobody cared for that idea. Matka liked the slippers, and Beryl had worked hard to make them. I know, said Stupid Schmelke. Matka can keep the slippers, but why must he wear them on his feet? Couldn't he wear them someplace else where they wouldn't get muddy and everyone could see them? Where? He could wear them on his hands. But I need to use my hands, said Matka. How can I pick up anything if my hands are inside a pair of slippers? You could tie them on a string and hang them round your neck, Esther Goose suggested. That's a stupid idea. My beard would cover them. Well, then stick them on your ears, snapped Esther. Ah, now that was a solution. Matka could wear the slippers on his ears. The slippers would keep his ears warm, everyone would be able to see them, and they wouldn't get covered with mud. Ever since that day, people honored as Knights of the Golden Slippers have the privilege of wearing a pair of slippers on their ears for an entire year. That's why it is always easy to identify Helm's wisest, most honored, and distinguished citizen. He's the one who walks around with a pair of slippers on his ears. Hi, I'm David Serksner, and this is one of the Hanukkah stories from Helm. The book is called The Jar of Fools by Eric A. Kimmel, and the story is Silent Samson the Maccabee. Everyone knows about Judah Maccabee and his heroic brothers. There would be no Hanukkah without them. Long ago, in ancient times, the Maccabees defeated the Greeks and saved the Jewish people. Helm had a Maccabee, too. His name was Silent Samson. Unlike Judah and his heroic brothers, Silent Samson did not wear armor or carry a sword, but he saved his people all the same. Had it not been for Silent Samson, Helm would have been destroyed. Every year, throughout the 8 nights of Hanukkah, the people of Helm tell his story. 400 years ago, an army of Cossacks overran Poland. The Cossacks were as cruel as Amalek in the Bible. They burned towns and cities by the score. They murdered people like flies. Death and destruction followed everywhere they went. A Cossack army led by the famous Hetman Chelmensky arrived at the gates of Helm. The soldiers guarding the walls had run away during the night. Helm was defenseless. The townspeople had no choice but to open the gates. The Cossacks marched into Helm. They were in a merry mood, eager for fun. Let's find 2 blind men and make them fight with clubs. Let's find some people who can't walk and make them race. Let's cut off some heads and play 9 pins. The Cossacks forced the people of Helm to line up in the town square. They looked them over one by one as they tried to decide what to do with them. The people of Helm shook with fear. Some began to weep. Others begged for mercy. The Cossacks laughed. Only one person did not cringe before the Cossacks. His real name has been forgotten. Everyone called him Silent Samson because he was big and strong, like Samson in the Bible. He was silent because he could not speak. Silent Samson had lost his hearing when he was a baby. He had never learned to talk. He communicated by making signs with his hands. Only his daughter could understand them. She interpreted for her father. Silent Samson was not afraid of anyone. He stood calmly, watching the Cossacks, his muscular arms folded across his broad chest. "Here's a stout fellow. We'll have some fun with him." One of the Cossacks grabbed Silent Samson's beard. Silent Samson picked him up and tossed him over his head. The Cossacks gasped to see their comrade flying through the air like a rag doll. Then they laughed. "Here's the one we want. We'll make him sorry he was ever born." Silent Samson turned to his daughter. He made signs with his hand. His daughter signed back. "What are they doing?" the Cossacks asked. My father can't talk. That is why he's called Silent Samson, the girl explained. We speak to each other with signs. The Cossacks started arguing. What shall we do with this fellow? Sew him in a sack and throw him in the river. Tie him to a tree and use him for target practice. Spread hot coals on the ground. Make him dance on them barefoot. We've done all that before, said Hetman Chametsky, the Cossack chief. I want some different entertainment. Our minds need a challenge. Let's have a debate. A debate? The Cossacks asked one another. Silent Samson can't talk. How can he debate anything? He can talk with his hands. We'll have a silent debate. A debate with signs instead of words. The Cossacks agreed that this would be good sport. Hetman Chmelnitsky pointed to one of his colonels. Here is Ataman Krivo, the cleverest of my officers. He can read and write. He has studied at the famous University of Krakow. He can speak Latin and Greek. Why, he has even been known to read books. Ataman Krivo beamed with pride. The other Cossacks nodded their heads as the Hetman continued. Ataman Krivo will represent us in the debate. The debate will be conducted entirely without words. At the end, I will decide who wins. If it is Silent Samson, we will leave Chelm as we found it. If it is Ataman Krivo, the town and everything in it belongs to us, to do with as we like. The people of Chelm had no choice but to agree to these terms. A table spread with bread, wine, and cheese was set up in the town square. Hetman Chmelnitsky sat down. He filled his goblet with wine and motioned for the debate to begin. Ataman Krivo approached Silent Samson. He held up both hands with his two index fingers crossed. Silent Samson did not hesitate. He held out his hands with his index and little finger pointed straight forward. Ataman Krivo frowned. The Cossacks and townspeople began to murmur. What did this mean? Ataman Krivo suddenly raised his right hand with all five fingers outstretched. Silent Samson raised his fist. Ataman Krivo hesitated. He turned to the table and filled a goblet with wine. He held it out to Silent Samson. Silent Samson picked up a piece of cheese. He offered it to Ataman Krivo. Ataman Krivo gave up. Silent Samson has beaten me, he said. How can a man who can't talk defeat a graduate of the University of Krakow? Cried Hetman Chmelnitsky. I will explain, said Ataman Krivo. I began by holding up two crossed fingers, meaning your people and mine have been enemies since the world began. Silent Samson answered by pointing two fingers at me as if to say, that is not true. In the beginning there were only two people, Adam and Eve. All the nations of the earth are their children. We belong to one family. Why can't we live in peace? That is true, Hetman Chmelnitsky agreed. It says so in the Bible. The Cossacks nodded their heads. Ataman Krivo continued, I tried another argument. I held up my hand with fingers outstretched as if to say, because of their sins, God exiled your forefathers from their land and scattered them throughout the world. Silent Samson replied by holding up his fist. He meant to say, that is true, but remember that the God who punishes sins also forgives them. One day he will gather us from the four corners of the earth to be one nation again. What could I say to that? Those very words were spoken by the prophets in the Bible. If the Bible says so, it must be true, the Cossacks agreed. I made one last effort, Ataman Krivo went on. I took a goblet of wine from the table and held it out to Silent Samson. I meant to say, it will be a long time before that happens. The sins of your people are as red as blood, as red as this wine. Yes, the Cossack shouted. What did he say to that? He held out the cheese, meaning, do we burn down cities? Do we kill people for sport? We may not be perfect, but compared to yours, our sins are as white as this cheese. Beware, Cossacks, if you do not change your ways, God will turn his face from you. He will deliver you into the hands of your enemies. You will vanish from the earth like the nations of old, and none will mourn your passing. The Cossacks looked at one another. Suddenly they felt frightened and ashamed. One by one they sheathed their swords. They put away their muskets and pistols. Without a word, they mounted their horses and rode out through the gates of Chelm, never to return. There was great rejoicing in Chelm that night. However, one question remained. How was Silent Samson able to speak so eloquently? He had never been to school. He could not read or write. The sages of Chelm asked Silent Samson's daughter to ask her father how he thought of such brilliant arguments. The girl signed to Silent Samson. He signed back. She began to laugh. What did he say? The people of Chelm asked. My father says, answering that ignorant Cossack was easy. When he crossed his fingers, I knew what he was up to. He was trying to put some evil spell on me. I pointed two fingers at him. He knew what I meant. Whatever you try to put on me will bounce back on you. That made him angry. He held up his hand to slap my face. I raised my fist. Try it, and I'll punch you in the nose. Realizing he couldn't scare me, he changed his tune and offered to be friends. Here, have some wine. Thanks, I said. Here's some cheese. That is how Silent Samson the Maccabee saved Chelm. Whether or not he realized it, his gestures contained great truth. The people of the world belong to one family. Perhaps they will understand that one day, as the people of Chelm do. In some ways, they are not so foolish after all.
Matthew Wood, Chrismica. Continuing the current trend of large-scale mergers and acquisitions, it was announced today at a press conference that Christmas and Hanukkah will merge. An industry source said that the deal had been in the works for about 1,300 years. While details were not available at the time, it was believed that the overhead cost of having both 12 days of Christmas and 8 days of Hanukkah was becoming prohibitive for both sides. By combining forces, we're told, the world would be able to enjoy consistently high-quality service during the 15 days of Chrismica, as the new holiday is being called. Massive layoffs are expected, with Lords Leaping and Maids of Milking being the hardest hit. As part of the conditions of the agreement, the letter on the dreidel, currently in Hebrew, will now be replaced by Latin, thus becoming unintelligible to a wider audience. Also, instead of translating, "A great miracle happened there," the message on the dreidel will be a more general, "Miraculous stuff happens." In exchange, it is believed that Jews will be allowed to use Santa Claus and his vast merchandising resources for buying and delivering their gifts. One of the sticking points holding up the agreement for at least 300 years was the question of whether Jewish children could leave milk and cookies for Santa even after having eaten meat for dinner. A breakthrough came last year when Oreos were finally declared to be kosher. All sides apparently are happy about this. A spokesman for Christmas Incorporated declined to say whether a takeover of Kwanzaa might be in the works as well. He merely pointed out that if it were not for the independent existence of Kwanzaa, the merger between Christmas and Hanukkah might indeed be seen as an unfair cornering of the holiday market. Fortunately for all concerned, he said, Kwanzaa will help to maintain a competitive balance. Then he closed the press conference by leading all present in a rousing rendition of Oy Vey, All Ye Faithful.
This is Mary Forrester reading from Christmas Classics, the story behind 40 favorite carols. And this is the story behind Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Who is Hark the Herald Angels Sing? Charles Wesley was the brother of John Wesley, founder of the Methodist movement. Unlike his brother, Charles was against splitting with the Church of England and specifically requested that he be buried by the Church of England when he died. He is best remembered for the thousands of hymns he composed, including Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Jesus, Lover of My Soul, and Christ the Lord is Risen Today. The music for Hark the Herald Angels Sing is from a cantata composed by Felix Mendelssohn to celebrate the invention of the printing press. What is Hark the Herald Angels Sing? In his original version, Wesley's first line was, "Hark, how all the welkin rings, glory to the King of Kings." The word welkin has largely fallen out of use these days, but in Wesley's time it meant the celestial sphere where the angels lived, everything heavenly. All of that, he insisted, must have rejoiced at the birth of Christ. In 1872, Hark the Herald Angels Sing was included as one of the four great Anglican hymns in the 1872 publication The Church Hymn Book. Two of those four hymns came from the pen of Charles Wesley, with the other one being Lo, He Comes with Clouds Descending. The Herald Angels may well have sung at the birth of Jesus, but with more than 6,500 hymns to his name, Charles Wesley certainly did his part to keep the rest of us singing about that wonderful event. When was Hark the Herald Angels Sing? The song was written in 1739, the same year that Great Britain declared war on Spain in the War of Jenkins' Ear. Where was Hark the Herald Angels Sing? Wesley published the song in his collection Hymns and Sacred Poems. The Wesley brothers had spent a few years traveling in the New World. On their return to Britain, they formed a group with other preachers and traveled around their homeland. It was during this time in England that Charles Wesley wrote Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Why is Hark the Herald Angels Sing? Well, popular legend says that Wesley heard the church bells ringing on Christmas Eve and felt compelled to write the words that, after changes by George Whitefield and several others, became Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Being of sober character, Wesley had his carol sung to a slow melody. 100 years later, it was paired with Mendelssohn's music to make an altogether more joyful sound.